Welcome to the IM Radio Network, where noted authority coaches, authors, and speakers collaborate and bring to you the best in radio, TV, and live events worldwide. And now, the IM Radio Network proudly presents the Dr. Simone Show with your host, Dr. Simone Reves. Get ready to go. Interactive.
Hello? Hello, this is Angela.
Hi, Angela, it's Meg. Do we have anybody else? I could barely hear her.
Likewise. I could hear her, but barely. Let's just stay on the phone and see what happens.
Okay.
They have a producer, so... Hello, Simone.
Hello, I can't hear you very well. Can you hear me?
Hello? Hi, everyone. It seems that Simone is having some difficulty with her mic right now. We're trying to get that fixed. So if you could just be patient.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oops. Okay, great.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear everybody now. It was apparently my mic.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't working. So, hello. Nice to have everybody on here.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Okay, so I'm going to just give a brief introduction about the show and about myself, and then I will cut to the chase and introduce both Dr. Spinelli and Angela Burling. This is Dr. Simone Rabbis, the Dr. Simone Rabbis Show, The Mind Body Edge. And we deal with issues that are at the cutting edge in terms of both physical and mental, emotional health and well-being. And today I have two amazing women joining me. I have a Dr. Margaret Spinelli, who I will talk about briefly. I'll give you an introduction. If you were a passenger in a car driving cross-country, you would want to have her resume with you because it would take about that long to read it. Her resume, her CV is incredible. Dr. Spinelli is triple board certified. She was a registered nurse as of 1968 and received her MD from Cornell University in 1988. She belongs to many professional organizations and societies, including serving as a Distinguished Life Fellow of the American Psychiatric Association. She's part of the American Medical Association, the Association of Women Psychiatrists, and a number of other groups. Now, she's also taught widely and is currently a clinical professor of psychiatry at Columbia University, amongst other appointments. She's the recipient of many honors and special appointments, and she's given lectures all over the world on issues involving women's health, psychopharmacology, and medical, psychiatric, and legal issues. Dr. Spinelli has been a consultant and a volunteer on many projects and has written a huge number of articles. She also has written a book entitled Infanticide: Psychosocial and Legal Perspectives on Mothers Who Kill. While she's a leading authority on postpartum mental illness, she strives to keep the human side of things as primary in her work. So welcome, Dr. Spinelli. It's such an honor to have you here.
Thank you, and thank you for the introduction.
Oh, my pleasure, my pleasure. As I said, it's quite, I was really amazed when I read through everything that you've done and all of your experience and your honors and everything. It's fantastic.
Thank you.
Sure. So today we're going to be discussing some difficult issues, some highly emotional, a highly emotional topic, and I believe that you're going to be giving us some information, some factual information about the mental health, postpartum mental health, and different conditions that women can develop, as well as some information about the legal issues that are involved with this subject, which
yes,
are many and are very important, obviously. So can you tell us a little bit about really getting down to the nitty-gritty, like some of the hormonal changes following childbirth and lactation and how that might lead to postpartum psychosis or postpartum depression?
Surely. Postpartum depression occurs in about 10 to 20% of women, but postpartum psychosis is quite rare, can present within the first month or later on.
Mm-hmm.
We usually associate rapidly alternating hormone changes with the symptoms. So, for example, if a woman is pregnant, over 40 weeks of pregnancy, the estrogen, progesterone go up maybe 400-fold. Then within 24 hours, they're gone. And what's interesting is I've had many women now who've come in when they completely stopped breastfeeding.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the hormone, probably oxytocin, but other estrogen and some other hormones will also become activated when oxytocin diminishes. So that probably has a lot to do with the onset of symptoms. So the way I explain it is that, for example, girls and boys have the same proportion of depression up until puberty.
Right.
And it's at that point that the rate for girls becomes about twice as high as boys. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that onset is because of the hormone changes. Now, again, hormone changes will actually affect the brain chemicals. That rapid drop in hormones under either circumstance,
So would it affect neurotransmitters such as serotonin or norepinephrine or anything of that nature?
Yeah, through a very kind of complicated system of organs, they actually interact with the brain chemicals.
Okay.
And it's those brain chemicals, when they are in disarray, that can precipitate psychiatric symptoms in women who have either had them before or have a family history, or sometimes it's the first onset.
You know, I'm wondering about the increased predominance of depression in girls in puberty. Do you think that has any backing in terms of, or any input because of the culture, the social influences that affect girls in puberty?
Oh, certainly. You know, even though I'm talking about biology,
right.
I mean, I think it's important to think about, although I think of biology in childbearing as being a primary trigger, you know,
sure.
Other issues, culture, social factors, environmental factors, emotional factors, all have some effects on the brain chemistry.
Okay.
So I think that it's completely, but it is notable that it does increase that much.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, I know that figure, but it always just shocks me when I hear it.
Yeah.
And it's such a rapid shift.
It is a rapid shift.
Right. So what is the difference, for those who don't know, between postpartum psychosis and postpartum depression?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and so important for people to differentiate. So it's important that if a woman has a postpartum depression, she doesn't feel like she might hurt her baby.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll explain that. Postpartum depression, women are tearful. They have changes in sleep or appetite. Anxiety is a major component of postpartum depression, with feelings being overwhelmed and guilty. And an important part is not being connected with the baby. So they see themselves as bad mothers,
right.
And then feel guilty. Now, mm-hmm. with postpartum psychosis, women lose contact with reality. What is real for them is not real for us, and vice versa. So they may hear voices that aren't there, see things that aren't there, or have delusions. And women who are psychic do not have the same reality as we do. And so their own space with voices and visions meant for them. Now, we consider it a psychiatric emergency.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
it sounds like it would be.
Yeah, because you want to be very concerned about the mothers and the babies because there's such a high risk of suicide and infanticide. Very dangerous, especially if the content of the hallucinations apply to the baby, such as delusions that they might think that the baby is the devil.
Mm-hmm.
So you really do have to be very cautious with these moms.
Right. Are there percentages in terms of the women with postpartum psychosis who do commit suicide?
Well, let me just first say that postpartum psychosis is rare. On the other hand, in bipolar women, the rate goes up tremendously. Like bipolar women can have about a 30% of having a serious postpartum episode. And if the woman is bipolar with a family history of postpartum psychosis, she has a 74% chance.
Oh, my gosh. That is incredible. And I was going to ask you, when I noticed that figure about bipolar being 30% rate of having postpartum psychosis, is that a genetic predisposition or is that, again, brain chemicals because of the bipolar, the nature of bipolar, that it changes brain chemicals and makes it more likely to develop PPP?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have found some, at least one study has found an identification of a gene in postpartum psychotic mothers who are bipolar.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting also, there's one of the, or two actually, chemicals in the immune system also change in women with postpartum psychosis who are bipolar.
Oh, that's very interesting.
So I assume that, you know, the work that's going to be done will be looking a lot more at heredity, genes, and the immune function of women with psychosis.
Right, right. That is just fascinating. Now, another figure that really stood out to me was the chance for reoccurrence in women who have postpartum psychosis, that there's a strong likelihood if they have it once that with the next birth they'll have it again.
Yeah, it's quite possible, but the good news is we know how to prevent it now. And basically what we do is we will medicate those women with a mood stabilizer at least, and probably antipsychotic either just before she delivers or at delivery.
Okay, okay. That's great. That's great to have that understanding and knowledge now.
Yeah. You asked about the rate of suicide in postpartum psychosis. It's not absolute, but we think it's around 3%. But I think what's most important is the highest rates of maternal suicide is in the first year of life are mothers with depression that is untreated.
Okay,
so,
untreated depression, okay. All right. Now, the postpartum psychosis and postpartum depression, are they related? For example, one might think the postpartum psychosis is just more severe, a severe case of postpartum depression, or are they completely distinct categories?
They are quite distinct. I mean, For postpartum depression, some women can become psychotic later on. But the distinction is that if somebody loses contact with reality, that is, they're seeing things that are not there, hearing things, having kind of bizarre beliefs, that would automatically be considered psychosis. So in some cases, it's a completely distinct an onset, but at other times, depressions can also become psychotic episodes.
Okay, okay. Yeah, and you know, a lot of women after they give birth they're called moody and they're not getting enough sleep, which can cause a number of problems in and of itself that can lead to them feeling not feeling very good about themselves and maybe not connecting well with the baby. How does one know when it's really postpartum depression and when it's just part and parcel of giving birth and having some changes in mood and energy?
Well, you know, about 50 to 80% of women will have what we would call postpartum blues.
Yeah.
And a feeling really good at one moment and then feeling a little down and tearful. We usually say that if it lasts more than 2 weeks, that you should definitely look at it as depression. But having said that, some women will get a very fast onset of depression. So I think if any woman has any questions, even during that time, she should get an evaluation.
Okay. Yep. Very better safe than sorry, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay. Now, I know that you've worked on legal issues in the area of postpartum mental health, and that our country treats infanticide, I believe, a little bit differently or sees it differently than a lot of European countries?
Yes, that's right. So in the United States, if a woman, because of her mental illness, kills her baby, she is usually charged with homicide, and she's usually incarcerated, which could be as long as a life in prison or even the death penalty.
Oh,
but
wow.
In the United Kingdom, Australia, Canada, and 29 European countries, they have something called infanticide laws. And those infanticide laws allow for the fact that if a mom kills her baby in the first year of life, she's first assumed to be mentally ill, then evaluated, and she will be charged with manslaughter, and she will be sent to a psychiatric hospital rather than a prison.
Okay. Okay. How long has that? Oh, I see. That's been long term for the British Infanticide Act. It says it goes back to 1939.
Yes.
Wow.
Well, actually, some of these. Actually, quite honestly, Russia, my understanding, was the first one to provide more humane handling of these women, and that was like back in 1637.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Wow, and it's hard to fathom that we in the U.S. here still have such a different approach.
Exactly. I agree.
Right. That's why the work that you do and others in your community is so critical in getting this knowledge out to people. You know, most people don't know anything about this.
Most people don't, and, you know, it's infanticide. It's, you know, a subject that is, on one hand, very compelling, and on the other hand, very repulsive.
Right.
And so I think what we tend to do is we lock the woman away, and then we can deny anything about it. And
right.
If we do that, we're not really looking at the causes and the symptoms, and therefore, we're not doing anything to prevent it either.
Absolutely. Well, there's a general human tendency to use denial quite a bit, isn't there?
Yeah, there really is. It's true.
Yeah. Now, you are currently working on a case?
Yes, I'm working on a case of a young woman in the Bronx who killed her six-month-old and her three-month-old in the first year after birth. And she had a very long history of bipolar disorder, and I evaluated her and saw that she had a postpartum psychosis, which I presented to the court.
Right.
And in some cases, even though it's not like the UK, we considered it quite positive because the judge acquitted her of first and second degree murder, and he charged her with manslaughter. We haven't gotten the word on sentencing yet, but he charged her with manslaughter secondary to impaired emotional well-being. So, I think that was very notable for us here. I mean, he was a very thoughtful judge, and we were just very pleased. And hopefully the sentencing will go well. And it would be nice to see if the courts in general would take these mental illness more seriously.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Wow, that's just, that's so amazing to, I guess it must be for you to work on cases like this that are so highly emotional.
They are emotional. I don't know how attorneys who are litigators do it.
Really?
Yeah. It is very charged and very difficult. And especially if you feel like you're not being heard.
Oh, yeah. Right, yeah. Right. Are there attorneys that specialize in this area?
Well, there are two attorneys that I know of who work in the area. Mm-hmm. There isn't exactly a specialty, but I know one from Andrea Yates' trial, and then I know one who worked on this trial and two others before this, but they're, you know, over many years.
Right. So if you could say what you would most like to see come out of your work and the work of others that is similar to yours, what would you most like to see in terms of public awareness? Go ahead.
Well, you know, I have to say, in almost every case of infanticide I've seen, it could have been prevented, and that's not purposeful, but it's people who did not identify the symptoms. And that's one of the major things we need to focus on. But we cannot focus on them, especially if we put these women away. I mean, these women are not aware of what they have done. They end up having to be incarcerated when they really need psychiatric treatment. And that would be the thing I would most want here, for our country to be more aware of this and accept it as a mental illness and give these women treatment rather than incarceration.
Right. I mean, is it even in the DSM-5, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual?
Well, you know, it's a whole history, but it's only in the DSM-5 as what we call a specifier. So you could put any mental illness down, and then you can just tack on.
Okay. Well, it deserves more than...
There were years when postpartum was completely taken out of the DSM.
Oh, okay. Well, Dr. Spinelli, I really want to thank you so much for joining us. What you shared with us was truly eye-opening, and I also hope that what you shared today is really going to be on people's minds and that it will help increase their awareness and they'll pass that on to other people. We have to go to a short break now, but thank you again so much for joining us.
You're quite welcome. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.
Bye. You too.
Okay, I believe we're going to go to a station break, and when we return, we will be speaking with Angela Burling, and she's going to be speaking on the same subject, giving us a little bit of a different perspective as somebody who's gone through and experienced what we've been discussing.
Hello, amazing listeners to the I Am Radio TV Network. We thank you so very much for being here with us today. We wanted to let you know we have an amazing opportunity coming up. We have available broadcast time. If you are a coach, author, speaker, or a business person looking to get your message out to the entire planet, then please get in touch with us as soon as possible, and we will go over the various levels of participation in our network. Again, we thank you for being with us here today. on the I Am Radio TV Network. Now, get ready to go. Interactive.
All right, welcome back to the Dr. Simone Show, the Mind Body Edge. And now we're going to be shortly joined by Angela. Are you there, Angela?
I sure am.
Okay, great. Well, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you. And Angela, I'm going to tell you a little bit, give you a bit of an intro to Angela. Angela earned her master's in nursing from California State University in Sacramento. And her thesis that she wrote in 1991 was entitled Screening Practices of Healthcare Practitioners for Postpartum Mental Illness. And we know from just what we've heard how critical it is for healthcare practitioners to know as much as possible about postpartum mental illness. Angela herself experienced postpartum mental illness, and her story was published in 2014 in a book entitled Motherhood, Mental Illness, and Recovery, Stories of Hope. In the late 1980s and the early 1990s, she became very busy. She appeared on a dozen talk shows, including Donahue, Oprah, and live on Larry King. And then Patty Duke narrated a documentary about Angela's experiences in 1989. Recently, Angela has been interviewed for two documentaries, which are currently in production. She's been married for 21 years and is the proud mother of two adult children. Angela currently volunteers in the community as a health educator and is on the board of Postpartum Support International. At her core is a desire to bring understanding about a tragic and misunderstood condition affecting mothers. So, welcome, Angela. It's so nice to have you here. How are you
doing today? Yeah, I'm doing fine, thanks.
Good.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a, like Dr. Spinelli said, It's both, it's compelling and repulsive.
Right.
You know, and I have to just say that for someone, there has to be like a societal shift in understanding in order to get people not to react viscerally to what's on the news. And to use, you know, to be more discerning as what the possibilities could be when a case is brought forth in the media.
Yeah, certainly. You know, Dr. Spinelli mentioned Andrea Yates, and I was taken back in time to that case that attracted so much attention, and that was now all the way back in 2001. Can you tell us a little bit more about that case?
Andrea, well, let me compare myself to Andrea.
Okay.
Andrea was a nurse, and she worked at MD Anderson Cancer Center, a very highly acclaimed, everybody knows MD Anderson, right?
Mm-hmm.
She was a champion swimmer, and she was the valedictorian of her high school class. And I could have been her. I could be sitting behind in a mental hospital for the rest of my life had I drowned my daughter or hurt my daughter and my son, who I did drown. And the reason is because we have so many similarities in our history. I'm a nurse. I'm a lifelong swimmer. I was the president of my senior class. And like Andrea, we both shared a common connection with God through our Christian faith. Andrea's psychosis led her to drown all five of her children. The oldest, Noah, was 7, and the youngest baby was Mary, who was 6 months. And she was completely delusional when this happened.
Yeah, of course.
Anyway, so she actually spent 4 years in prison awaiting an appeal that was based on the fact that there was inaccurate testimony given by one of the expert witnesses on the defense, on the prosecuting side. So now she is being treated in a mental hospital in Texas.
Okay, good. So now she's where she needs to be. But she did have
those four years in
prison, which must have been terribly difficult.
I can only imagine. And that's the difference between our cases. When my husband at the time, Jeff, and the father of my children, when he came home, and I told him that Michael was dead, he was, of course, in shock and disbelief.
Right.
But managed when the 911 call was made and the authorities came, he pleaded with the detectives who interviewed me to take me to a mental hospital, and that I'd had something like this following Allison's birth, and then thank God, I just feel so grateful that they did take me to a mental hospital.
Right.
And I never did spend time in jail.
Oh, wow. That's wonderful.
I know. And this was in the 80s.
It was still early on.
There's more awareness. Yeah. I lived in Davis,
mm-hmm.
California, which is a very educated community.
Mm-hmm.
It's a university town, and so I just feel that I had the opportunities that women in my circumstance should all have, and that is immediate mental health treatment.
So that's akin to the European models.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And
can you
then
tell us a little bit more about, in your particular case,
mm-hmm.
what was underlying? You had postpartum psychosis, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit more about your experience with that and what led to the drowning of your son, Michael?
Well,
so you had stopped nursing, right?
What had happened is that I had stopped nursing Michael. He was drinking out of a bottle. He was eating with Cheerios with his fingers. I mean, he was 9 months old. So he was, you know, I was ready. He was ready, I felt. And I had been working part-time at a local hospital as a nurse. And I went through that hospital. I was pregnant while I had Michael, and then I worked postpartum part-time. And I had a 4-hour shift, so it was really nice. I could work just very part-time and be home most of the time with my kids. So when I stopped nursing Michael, I became psychotic very shortly thereafter. I did something that they don't recommend now, and that is, as I was becoming engorged after stopped nursing, I bound my breasts because I was so uncomfortable and I wanted to just relieve the pressure.
Right.
And that enhanced the oxytocin factor, which led to the psychosis.
So how does binding the breast cause the problems?
Well, they're recommending now if you want to stop breastfeeding, you do it in a more slower way.
A gradual way?
You do it gradually.
Okay.
So
okay.
You just, it's like it, you create a like a perfect storm of hormones in your body when you do something like bind your breasts, which I didn't know. And I had asked a friend and my babysitter, you know, I said, hey, I'm going to stop nursing. What do you think about this plan? And they're like, oh, yeah, I did that. I did the same thing. So it just happened to me because I had a predisposition having had a psychosis with Allison.
Right.
But what happened in my mind when we lost the baby was that I started having delusions, religious delusions. I believe Jeff was Jesus. His name
Jeff was your
peace.
Husband at the time?
Jeff was my husband.
Okay.
His name means peace. Mm-hmm. I believed I was Jesus, the messenger of God, because my name is Angela, which is taken from angel as a messenger. And then I believed Michael, whose name means who is like God. In my twisted and distorted thinking, I believed that he was the devil and that I needed to drown him to, like, expunge the world of evil.
Right.
I believed with all my heart that Jeff would raise Michael from the dead in 3 days. And the world would know that Jeff was Jesus and peace would come to the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, that's the mindset of a delusional woman.
You can see how disconnected from reality, how far from reality it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's pretty amazing.
I was very far gone.
Right.
And the tragedy is that since I had the episode with Allison, and I, during my pregnancy, the first visit I had with my nurse midwife was that I said to her that I had this, I had explained to her about what had happened during my postpartum with Allison, and then that I had been hospitalized and that I had done some just really crazy things. And she looked at me and she said, well, you don't have to worry about that happening again. And so I came home to Jeff and I told him that, and we're just like, oh God, thank God. That was the worst. It almost destroyed our marriage at that point. Because of the blame. I was blaming him. He was blaming me. And was like, okay, we just drew a truce. We are not going to talk about this. Because it just, of all, you know, everything that went with the whole psychosis, you overanalyze everything. You try to think, what's wrong with you? What's wrong with me? It was terrible after Allison, what we went through together, Jeff and I.
Did you have postpartum psychosis with her?
Yes, I did.
Okay. And this nurse, or I'm sorry, the midwife, told you that you didn't need to be worried.
Yes. And,
which is amazing, given what Dr. Spinelli said about the increased incidence.
Yeah, 70%.
Someone who's already had it once.
It's 70%. Yeah. I was a time bomb. I was a ticking time bomb. And I don't, at this point, the blame really doesn't lie specifically with her, because at that point, postpartum psychosis wasn't as understood in I think she gave me the best information she could at the time.
That she had, right. But it's amazing to see that the doctors... Didn't the doctor say anything when you became pregnant after Allison and you had the PPP? Didn't they say anything about possibilities with your next child?
I had, first of all, in the 80s, early 80s when this happened, I was hospitalized. I was given maybe 4 different diagnoses, all of which I totally rejected because I was not mentally ill. We had no mental illness in our family. We had, it was just something that I really thought I had PTSD from Allison, from her crying and her colic. She was very colicky, and I just thought, I went crazy because I couldn't stand the screaming.
Right.
That's how I was able to justify the psychosis
mm-hmm.
in my mind at
right.
the time, because it, this was back, it's not exactly the dark ages in the 80s, but it felt like it. And
yeah.
the stigma that was attached to having a mental illness, and I felt it. I felt so out of place that
mm-hmm.
I had been in a mental hospital, and it just, I felt
something
really
you don't want to share with people.
It's not something you talk about with your neighbor.
Right.
And anyway, yeah, so anyway, yeah. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, that, but I was also fortunate that not only did Jeff able to, you know, to convince the authorities to send me to a mental hospital, he got the best criminal defense attorney in town in Sacramento to defend me, and when Jeff went and explained my case to the attorney, the attorney's exact words were, "Angela could have been my wife."
Wow.
And he, you know, he and Jeff were crying when Jeff told them what had happened, and
oh man,
totally got it. You know, he's like,
yeah.
I get this. And then
right. There can't. I mean, this is the whole, I guess, the legal issues, you know, and assigning blame and responsibility to somebody who is not rational.
Right.
And I think, I mean, that's one of the problems with why they're struggling, and they have been, with changing the laws in this country,
mm-hmm.
is how to deal with those issues.
Mm-hmm.
So when this occurred to you,
mm-hmm.
what was it that helped you make it through, that helped you cope with it? Because, I mean, I just can't even imagine.
I know.
That,
that
happening. What helped you get through it?
Yeah, it was absolutely devastating. I think the biggest and most important factor was that my husband Jeff believed in me.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly don't know if I would have recovered if he had not stood by me and defended me and believed in me and knew that I personally was innocent of the act, because I did not know what was happening in my mind.
Right.
He got it, and he the love that we shared, and the bond, and the friendship, and the just everything we had together as a couple, and our children, Alice, you know, my daughter Allison, and then Michael, we had such a happy family before this happened. I mean, we were just like living the life of our dreams with these two children, and in our 20s, and
right.
Working and going to church, and I was canning my cherries off my tree.
Yeah.
Swimming.
Yeah.
Anyway, but what helped me cope was also the support of my family and my friends, and my neighbors rallied and supported me and attended every court appearance that I had.
That's amazing. How did
and my parents?
Mm-hmm. How did it get out, so to speak, what had happened? Did your neighbors come and ask you what had happened, or did you volunteer the information?
No, I was at this point. I was locked up. I was in a psychiatric facility for 30 days. I didn't talk to them. They just supported me because they knew me.
Yeah.
You know, these are women that we'd have our garages open, and we'd be doing laundry across the street from each other and talking to each other for
right. You were really close to them
before this happened, so I was very, you know, I was close to them.
Right.
And then, you know, having the top forensic psychiatrist, I had a top forensic psychiatrist also in SAC, Romano, who helped me cope and understand the physiology of my illness,
mm-hmm.
and understanding that, you know, the underlying biological changes that happened in my body
right.
and mind that created the psychosis. So, and also, I think having, well, being found not guilty by reason of insanity to the charges of manslaughter was like the biggest relief.
Relief,
of
right.
Life that I had the opportunity then, because of that finding, to enter the conditional release program, which is in California. And
what does that entail?
Well, it entails really intensive education and therapy and groups. And I had a nurse who was the director of mental health, and she taught me how to, like, identify the symptoms when they would come.
Uh-huh.
If I was having problems, she taught me how to manage my illness.
Okay.
One of the key things there is, you know, not be afraid to say something about it. Like, don't keep it a secret.
Right.
If you're starting to have thoughts, do not keep that a secret. Get it out. Get it out. Talk to someone about it. Get help.
Right.
So she helped me tremendously. And then also I had a medical social worker and the county psychiatrist, as well as my private psychiatrist, who also helped me. And then I was very fortunate after my recovery, and my parents, of course, they were awesome.
Oh, that's great. That's
everything.
Really important.
I did have everything in my favor. The judge actually, we were able to get the bail reduced from $250,000 to $50,000, and the judge allowed me to go home with my parents
during
the trial.
Yeah,
and
what
so,
a big difference that makes, you know.
Oh, and so I was with my mom and dad. They
right.
were both retired at the time, and so it just, I was home, the home I'd been raised in for my entire life. It was like I was
yes.
home.
Yeah.
And it made such a difference.
Right, you were in a place of love and support.
Exactly. And then I read a Harold Kirshner's book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People, and I just felt like, oh, God, what a relief.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I was one of those people that was
right. Yes.
all my life. And it was
yep.
like, I got it, you know.
People often talk about that book. When bad
mm-hmm.
things happen to good people. I've had so many of my clients bring that book up that they've read,
mm-hmm.
or I've even recommended for them to read that book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it puts
wonderful.
In perspective tragedies
mm-hmm.
and tragic situations. And then I met a woman named Jane Honickman from Santa Barbara, who was the founder of Postpartum Support International. And one of the things she said to me was, you're just who we need. You're intelligent. You're attractive. And you're a professional. You are a good spokeswoman for this cause. And it also didn't hurt. I mean, I think it's true. I don't think it hurt that I was white.
Okay.
I'm a white woman. And
right. Right, probably so.
I think that also helped me.
Right, right.
And
so
then,
that must have felt confirming to hear that.
From Jane? Oh, my gosh, yeah.
Yeah.
And then I linked up with Dr. Susan Hickman, who has since passed, but she was an expert in the field, and she went on the various TV shows with me as an expert witness.
Okay.
And she validated my experience.
Now, I heard that we have, let's see, we have 6 minutes left, and
okay.
I know that we want to announce two events that you're going to be talking mm-hmm. about, and you wanted to mention your upcoming book. What
mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you is, what changes, briefly, do you want to see around this topic?
Well, the main change I would like to see is like Dr. Spinelli, that women be sent to mental hospitals following this.
Right.
in an ideal world, I'd like to see the adoption of the British Infanticide Act of 1939 by all 50 states.
Okay, and that's the one she explained to us that after,
right,
within a year period.
Yes.
That the woman would be given manslaughter.
Well, it's actually, yeah,
and that they would get psychiatric care.
Correct.
Okay.
One of the most important things is for
people,
a woman who has the psychosis doesn't realize that she's psychotic. So it's,
right,
people around her need to be aware of,
right,
what, and also there's an element of she may sound a little normal at times.
Uh-huh.
And it's called a mercurial aspect because she may sound normal a little bit, but then she'll,
right,
slip into a psychosis and not appear right. And then when a tragedy occurs, I'd like to see that a mother be sent taken to a mental hospital.
Mm-hmm.
There should be a video recording of the psychotic mother immediately.
Okay.
So that psychosis is, and to be used by the defense, so that the,
right,
mother, it's shown, it's like, this is, look at her, right?
Right.
Listen to her.
Right, right. I can see how that would help tremendously.
Yeah, and because it's a temporary illness,
yeah,
and it responds well to medication and therapy. So, mm-hmm, and I'd like to see more research, like,
mm-hmm,
it is doing at the University of North Carolina into the, it's only in the data collecting stages now, but the biological causes of PPD.
Okay.
And more training for professionals.
More training.
Especially in underserved areas, as well as more training for perinatal reproductive psychiatrists. And
right. So education, awareness, adoption of, changes in the law,
mm-hmm,
those are all,
mm-hmm,
definitely well needed.
Mm-hmm. And for women.
Now, Angela, tell me about these two events that are coming up that you wanted to mention.
Okay. The Postpartum Support International Conference, Bridging Bonding and Beyond, is June 22nd through the 25th with a certificate training program.
Mm-hmm.
It's in San Diego. And if you enroll by May 6th, there is a early bird, discount. And and the other one is a World Mental Health Day, Wednesday, May 4th, to increase awareness by national and local government of this critical issue.
All right, great. So that's Wednesday, May 4th, World Maternal Mental Health Day. Angela, thank you so much for joining me today. And
you are so welcome. Thank you.
I'm sorry?
Thank you for having me.
Oh, sure. It was really a pleasure, and this is such an important topic. I thank you for sharing with me today and with all the listeners.
Welcome.